Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When we listen on Audible, we are unconfined, free to travel the worlds inside our minds, where time moves faster, stops, rewinds. So let's walk and dance a mile in other shoes. Whatever's next is ours to choose. There's more to imagine when we listen. Audiobooks, podcasts, originals. Start listening now at Audible.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 18th of May. Russia launches more missiles at Ukraine, the ninth attack this month. Rescue efforts continue in northern Italy after floods kill at least 9 people. And South Africa's state-owned energy company warns of more severe power cuts. Also in the podcast, Australian police are accused of tasering a 95-year-old great-grandmother with dementia. And
music cannot be owned by any one person or entity, much less artificial machine intelligence. For songs, for expressing emotions, I don't think I will be moved by it.
As he wins a songwriting award, Sting tells us his views on AI in music. Over the past 24 hours, Ukraine says it's taken back more territory from the Russian invaders in the eastern city of Bakhmut. But its full-scale counter-offensive has yet to begin. Western officials say the Ukrainian military is at, quote, an increased state of readiness. But they have tried to play down expectations of dramatic breakthroughs, saying Russia has built up strong defences. Ukrainian MP Inna Sovsun told the BBC it was important not to start the operation too soon.
We understand that the only way to end this war is for us to win, to take back all of our territory. So yes, of course, everybody hopes for the counteroffensive and for it to be successful. However, with almost 1 million persons serving in the army right now, basically every family has someone who is there on the battlefront right now. So nobody is pushing publicly for the counteroffensive to start before we are completely ready, before Ukrainian army can launch this counteroffensive with as little casualties as possible. We want to save the lives of our soldiers, but also we want to take back the land, and we need to find the best point of time where those two can coincide.
Ukrainian MP Inna Sovsun. In the occupied Crimean Peninsula, Russian officials say a train carrying grain derailed, blaming the intervention of third parties. Overnight, Russia launched yet another air attack deep behind the front lines in Ukraine, though the Ukrainians say almost all the missiles were shot down. I heard more from our diplomatic correspondent James Landale in Kyiv.
Well, what we know is this is the ninth time that Kyiv has been targeted so intensely since the beginning of the month. The Ukrainian armed forces say that across the country, 30 missiles were launched, and they say that they managed to bring down 29 of them. So here in Kyiv, we heard explosions at various stages during the night. We've seen smoke on the horizon. There have been reports of damage from debris in 2 eastern districts, but no reports of casualties there. But we do know that in one of the areas that was attacked, in Odessa in the south, one person did die and 2 people were injured. And clearly the trend here is moving away from targeting just critical national infrastructure and, you know, power plants, things like that. But now very much Western officials say they're focusing on trying to damage and deplete Ukraine's air defences ahead of any potential counteroffensive.
Yeah, it's interesting that they've carried out so many of these missile strikes over the past month. I thought the Russians were supposed to be running out of these, what they call precision munitions, but obviously not.
What's been the pattern as the war has gone on? If you remember at the beginning of the war, there were mass attacks. Those days aren't happening now. What happens now is that Russia builds up its stocks, and when it thinks it's got enough missiles to fire, then it uses them and tries to use them, you know, with strategic effect rather than sort of using them piecemeal. They have a limited amount, but clearly now they are beginning to dip into the really high-tech missiles. And the problem with that is that they're really struggling to get the technology now. All those Western sanctions that were applied last year are beginning to bite. There's a lot of technology, not just missiles, but also, you know, the most modern tanks that Russia's got that are incredibly technically advanced, and they require, you know, very technical bits of kits and chips and all manner of things. And that Russia is struggling to get.
And what do you make of these latest comments from Western officials about this much heralded Ukrainian offensive? So it sounds like they're sounding a note of caution.
What Western officials are doing is they're echoing what British ministers and other Western leaders are saying in public, which is that as and when this offensive begins, don't expect it to produce fast results. I think there's a bit of expectation management going on to try and say, look, you know, whatever happens, this is not going to end the war immediately. It's going to be, you know, slow, hard fighting. But there's also, I think, a recognition that this offensive doesn't just have military aims. It's not there simply to retake territory from Russian forces. It is also there to try, according to these Western officials, to try and change minds in the Kremlin. They use this phrase, they want it to have cognitive effect on President Putin. In other words, convincing Russia's president, they hope, that he cannot just simply wait out the war. In other words, he can't rely on the status quo and just hope for a time will come when the West loses interest, when perhaps there's a change of leadership in the United States and they stop giving quite so much aid and military support to Ukraine, perhaps waiting for a time when Europe becomes more divided and focused on other issues. I think they want to, their aim is to try to change minds in the Kremlin. Say, actually, you know, if we stick with the wait and see strategy, that won't work because the Russian forces simply aren't able to hold the line in Ukraine.
James Landale in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Large parts of northeastern Italy remain on red alert as a result of serious flooding after 2 days of heavy rain. At least 9 people have died and 13,000 been evacuated. One resident of the city of Faenza, Kelly Shark, said the speed of the flooding had taken people by surprise.
I was expecting the river to rise after the red alert warning came through, but instead of breaking through in 2 or 3 places, it burst its banks and the water came with no warning. What can we do? We are waiting for the help of civil protection teams. They're not here at the moment, so we are volunteering in order to save our houses.
The affected area, Emilia-Romagna, had already been hit by downpours 2 weeks ago. Our correspondent Sofia Bettiza is there.
I'm just south of Bologna and I'm standing right next to a river, one of the 21 rivers that broke their banks and inundated entire villages and towns here in the region. Several of those towns are still underwater as we speak. And where I am at the moment, people have told me that their village was taken over by mud and by water. They're very scared and they don't quite know what to do. 9 people have died, several drowned in their own homes. And one woman was dragged for more than 20 kilometres by the torrents before her body was recovered on a beach.
That is quite extraordinary. I mean, this is one of Italy's richest regions. How much help are the authorities providing?
The Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, held a crisis meeting yesterday. She said that the government is monitoring the situation and is ready to approve emergency aid. But people here have told us that they're very disappointed with how the government has been responding so far. You know, I spoke to somebody who's lived here for 70 years. He said he'd never seen anything like this. And, you know, I saw as he was trying to get rid of the water in his house with pots and pans and buckets and said there's been zero help from the government or any local authority. On top of that, there's been lots of people who are urging the government to put in place a national plan so that Italy can be better prepared to deal with floods caused by climate change.
Sofia Bettiza in Emilia-Romagna in northeastern Italy. Despite being Africa's most industrialised nation, South Africa is in the grip of one of the world's worst energy crises. Rolling power outages are now routine in order to stop the national grid collapsing. Today, South Africa's state-owned energy firm Eskom warned the situation is likely to get even worse, as I heard from our Africa editor, Richard Hamilton.
Basically, South Africa, they have a thing called load shedding, which means that when power stations cannot meet demand for electricity, the power is then switched off to parts of the grid to protect the system from total collapse. And these are these power outages you're talking about. And Eskom said that they're going from stage 6 power cuts to stage 8. So it's going to be much more severe, and people could have power cuts of 12 hours a day, 10 hours a day. And the executive said the alternative, which is a blackout, is a nightmare scenario because it's an uncontrolled situation where the whole country loses electricity supply. And, of course, the effects of this is that the heating goes off, traffic lights don't work, there are traffic jams, food rots in the fridge, you can't cook your meals, hospital supplies like medicine and vaccines can't be kept in the fridge, and also there's an increasing crime in the darkness.
Now, this has been going on for years in South Africa. Why haven't they fixed it, and why is it getting worse?
Yeah, you're right. In February, President Cyril Ramaphosa declared the energy crisis a national state of disaster, saying it was an existential crisis. He's since backtracked on that. But that you're right, there were warnings more than 20 years ago. Eskom said it needed much more investment, and the ANC, basically the governing national party, ignored that. And I used to live in Cape Town 20 years ago, and you could see some of these coal plants were built in the 1960s. They were old, inefficient, prone to breakdown. They were poorly maintained. 80% of South Africa's power comes from coal-fired plants and only 7% from renewable energy. So they need to make that transition, but it's basically too costly. President Ramaphosa said it would cost $84 billion to make that transfer. And it suffered, as you say, from years of lack of investment.
Africa editor Richard Hamilton. The leaders of some of the world's wealthiest countries are arriving in the Japanese city of Hiroshima for a G7 summit. Top of the agenda is likely to be China's increased aggression towards Taiwan. But this could well highlight a contradiction over Japan's attitude towards defence. Late last year, the government announced plans to double defence spending by 2027, a move welcomed by its close ally, the United States. But after World War II, Japan adopted a pacifist constitution, and this is supposed to prevent it taking part in any conflict unless attacked. To examine Japan's dilemma, our Tokyo correspondent Shaima Khalil travelled to Okinawa, home to both US and Japanese air bases.
It's a busy morning on the runway of the Naha Military Air Base here in Okinawa. I've watched at least half a dozen F-15 jets take off. Most of these planes are part of the daily training program, mostly combat scenarios. But at least two, I've been told, have responded to emergency calls to intercept Chinese planes. These routine military exercises have become more urgent. Japan's southwestern islands are on the front line of any potential conflict between Taiwan and China. Captain Yuma Ura and his colleagues know that any response would have to involve their American counterparts. Okinawa is home to the biggest concentration of U.S. military presence in Japan. But the young pilot tells me that as China's capabilities increase, so too should his squadron's readiness to retaliate.
When I scramble to intercept the planes and see Chinese aircraft in front of me, I naturally feel a sense of tension. But it also makes me realize that I'm on a mission at the front line of national defense.
Last year, the government announced the biggest military buildup since the Second World War. But remember, Japan's constitution forbids it from engaging in battle unless attacked. This is a pacifist nation now facing the potential of a conflict at its doorstep. Be it from a belligerent North Korea, whose nuclear capabilities are being developed at an alarming rate, or because of China's aggression against Taiwan, the self-ruling island which Beijing sees as a breakaway province. Any of these scenarios will inevitably play out here. An hour's flight from Okinawa, Maine, is Ishigaki Island, a picturesque haven known for fishing and agriculture, and whose white sands and tropical waters have long attracted holidaymakers. But beyond this facade of calm stands Japan's newest military base. Nearly 600 troops have moved here earlier this year, including squads capable of launching land-to-ship and land-to-air missiles into the East China Sea and beyond. Mayor Yoshikata Nakayama tells me that Ishigaki's location makes it quite vulnerable.
We are very close to Taiwan and Southeast Asia. We are in a situation where Chinese ships are patrolling very closely. The equipment we have, in terms of missile launches, is for defending ourselves. It's not for attacking other countries. We're not looking for war.
This sense of crisis has also been heightened after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoko Iwama, professor of international relations at the National Graduate Institute for Foreign Policy, says the similarities are enough to alarm people here in East Asia.
It really brought home to normal people in Japan what it means to have a war now in this 21st century developed world.
Is it fair to draw parallels between the Russian invasion of Ukraine and a potential conflict between China and Taiwan?
I think there is a similarity that people notice, which makes people afraid. This bombing of Kyiv and other major cities, that I think that brought up the memories of Second World War city bombings in Japan. But those were supposed to be decades behind us.
But it's exactly those memories that have angered people here in Ishigaki, who fear that their small peaceful island might once again be caught up in conflict. The military base has split a once close-knit community. Every week, 85-year-old activist Satsuko Yamazoto stands in the fields outside the base to protest.
As a person who has experienced the Second World War, I don't want the tragic situation to be repeated. I don't want this island to become a battlefield.
Japan has not fired a single shot in battle since the end of World War II. But this country that has spent decades avoiding conflict might find itself being pulled into one.
Shaiba Halil reporting from Okinawa in Japan. The earliest and most comprehensive Hebrew Bible has been sold at auction in New York, fetching more than $38 million, one of the highest ever prices for a manuscript. The Codex Sassoon was bought by a former American diplomat, who will now donate it to a museum in Israel. Dr. Orit Shaham Gova is the curator of the Anu Museum of the Jewish People in Tel Aviv in Israel, which displayed the Bible before the auction.
It's in amazing condition for a 1,100 years old book. It is made of parchment. It's big. It's like a half a meter wide, and it has 400 pages in it, most of them in a very good condition. All the letters are very clear. Nothing was erased in the original. And all the comments of the generation of sages are on the top page and the bottom of the page. And it's amazing to look at the visitors, the Israeli visitors, and not only Israelis, who were 10,000 people saw it when it was in the week it was in Israel. And it was so exciting to see the people who are fascinated by the way, by the fact that they can read those letters and understand them, though they were written so many years ago. This is so exciting that I can't even imagine how to describe it. For me as a curator, this is the highest point of my career. And for the people of Israel, is to be able to own again the most important item of the cultural Jewish history, and to be able to present it to the public. It was always hidden somewhere in somebody's collection, and now everyone will be able to see it. I find it fascinating.
Dr. Orit Shaham Gova. Still to come on the podcast.
It's the largest study in the world where, in the general population, where we're enabling researchers to look at changes in the structure and the function of our internal organs as we get older.
How the world's biggest human imaging project will help treat and prevent disease.
National Car Rental has your back, road warriors, because we know you're picking up the pace, steering life at 10 and 2. You're hitting the road, and National's helping you get there with the confidence of our complete clean pledge. So skip the counter without missing a beat and choose any car in the aisle. National Car Rental. Go like a pro. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.
When we listen on Audible, we are unconfined. free to travel the worlds inside our minds, where time moves faster, stops, rewinds. So let's walk and dance a mile in other shoes. Whatever's next is ours to choose. There's more to imagine when we listen. Audiobooks, podcasts, originals. Start listening now at Audible.
Media in Australia have been reporting that a 95-year-old great-grandmother with dementia was tasered by police inside her nursing home. Officers were reportedly investigating claims she was carrying a knife. Terry Egan reports.
The woman was allegedly tasered by the police at a care facility, Coomer's Yolamba Lodge, run by the Snowy Monaro Regional Council. An independent politician, speaking with the family's permission, claims she was tasered in the early morning, having been found wandering with a knife in her hand. He said she was tasered twice, once from in front and once from behind, then fell and struck her head. The 95-year-old was apparently left with a fractured skull and brain bleed and taken to Coomer District Hospital. The politician says her family do not expect her to survive. In February, the Law Enforcement Conduct Commission, responsible for investigating allegations of misconduct, released a review after examining more than 200 incidents. These involved the use of force by New South Wales police officers for a year from May 2020. Tasers, said the commission, had been deployed in 16 of the incidents. Josh Pallas, who's president of the New South Wales Council for Civil Liberties, called on the police to stop using tasers on vulnerable people following this case. The regional council, meanwhile, said it's supporting staff, residents and families during what it called a difficult time, and the police have said they're launching an investigation that would be subject to an independent review.
Terry Egan reporting. The world's biggest human imaging project is to re-scan the brains and bodies of 60,000 volunteers in the UK to find new ways to treat and prevent disease. Our medical editor, Fergus Walsh, is one of those taking part.
It's nearly a decade since UK Biobank began doing MRI scans, bone density measurements and other detailed images of volunteers. I'm the first of them to have been re-scanned as part of a project to map subtle differences in the ageing body. Scientists say it will help develop early biomarkers of disease, perhaps many years before symptoms appear. 500,000 adults gave consent for their DNA, lifestyle information and medical records to be shared anonymously with researchers as part of UK Biobank. And as participants age, the information becomes ever more valuable.
Fergus Walsh. Well, the project's chief scientist, Naomi Allen, says the data could prove very useful.
The real unique thing about this repeat imaging study in UK Biobank is it's the largest study in the world where in the general population where we're enabling researchers to look at changes in the structure and the function of our internal organs as we get older. So what that means is it will enable research, for example, into what are the genetic and lifestyle factors that influence how our brains change as we get older, which may help to identify early biomarkers of dementia, for example.
What have we discovered so far using the biobank? What have we learned? Has it advanced medical science?
Well, there are already over 7,000 publications produced from at least 30,000 different researchers from around the world using the resource. But I think one of the biggest things that so far is coming out of the UK Biobank is the identification of genetic factors that can influence an individual's risk of developing a certain disease.
Just tell us where this biobank fits within the current quite exciting field of research about trying to slow down or even potentially in some future glorious dystopian world, reverse ageing.
All of our 500,000 participants now, they're in their mid-50s to the mid-80s. And now we've actually got a fantastic window of opportunity to collect more data on participants like Fergus and the other 500,000 to really look at what are the factors that influence how we age and why do some people develop certain chronic diseases and other people don't. So, you know, with more resourcing, the more data that we can collect on these individuals, the better understanding we'll have on how we age.
Naomi Allen talking to Amal Rajan. Escaping from the secretive Stalinist state of North Korea is difficult and dangerous. Getting out became even harder when borders were closed because of the COVID pandemic. But South Korean officials say that earlier this month, a number of North Koreans defected after travelling through heavily defended waters in a fishing boat. Jean McKenzie in Seoul has the details.
The government here is being really careful about what it releases at this stage because it's sensitive stuff. They're all now being questioned by authorities here, which is why this is all a bit hush-hush still. Because when North Koreans arrive in South Korea, they first get questioned for weeks, sometimes months, by the intelligence services. And that's just to check that they are who they say they are, that they're, crucially, they're not North Korean spies. Then they're sent to a resettlement centre where they're taught all about life in South Korea. So this process can take, you know, sometimes up to 6 months before they're resettled in society.
Jean McKenzie in Seoul. Well, staying in South Korea, a new study says 1.5 million people there are at risk of dying alone, with men in their 50s and 60s most at risk. The number of lonely deaths, where people die and aren't discovered, is growing in South Korea. But now AI could be used to flag up if people living alone suddenly stop using their water or electricity. I heard more from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
It's a problem in a lot of countries that have aging societies. Japan is a good example. South Korea is a little bit unusual, partly because the number of people who are dying alone, and there's actually a legal definition to this. So somebody who lives alone dies an unattended death, they call it, and whose body isn't found for a few days. The thing about South Korea is that it's people across a very wide age range that seem to be facing this problem. So not people in their just in their 70s and 80s, but people starting as early as their 20s. Now, as you said, you know, men who live alone in their 50s and 60s are at greatest risk. But really, I think this has really raised alarm bells across South Korea that something really needs to be done about this. Because, as I said, the numbers are going up every year.
I mean, a related issue in the US, the Surgeon General there recently warned of the health risks of loneliness and was urging Americans to spend more time with each other despite the distractions of the digital age. What's the South Korean government trying to do about the problem there?
They've come up with a checklist of 10 things that really highlight people who are at high risk of experiencing this. And one of the key things is people who have social interactions at least once a week. If you have at least one social interaction a week, that lessens your risk. But they've also come up with lots of other ideas. So, for example, they've got re-employment programs for people who live alone but who had retired early. They want to try to get them out and working again. They've also got neighborhood committees that go and check up on people who live alone. And as you mentioned earlier, they're starting to look at high-tech ways to tackle this. So artificial intelligence, can they monitor the electricity or the communications use of people who live alone to just make sure if there's a sudden drop, they know what to do? And last, they're really trying to push the idea of mental health checkups. So this is the idea that you don't just go to the doctor every 10 years or so to get a physical checkup. Maybe every 2 years you go and get a mental health checkup. And that's something that they're really trying to push, not just for people who live alone, but for everybody.
And is this partly a hangover from the pandemic?
Absolutely. I mean, I think they really saw the numbers start to jump during the pandemic and even since. So they're going up about 9% a year, the number of people who die alone. And this is simply because social ties were weakened during the pandemic. We all got used to being home a little bit more. Maybe those social ties that you'd established before that weren't quite so strong, maybe they broke down during the pandemic and simply haven't been reestablished again.
Our Asia Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton. Well, we heard about one of the possible benefits of AI there, but one person who's not happy about the technology being used in music is the songwriter Sting. The 71-year-old former police frontman said the next few years would see a battle to defend what he called the human capital of music. It comes after an increase in the number of songs created using AI, mimicking the likes of Eminem, Drake or Oasis. Sting, real name Gordon Sumner, has been talking to the BBC's Mark Savage as he prepares to receive one of the music industry's most prestigious songwriting awards.
We are here because you're being given the fellowship of the Ivor Novello's Academy. Now, for people who don't know what that is, explain why that's so important.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like Lord of the Rings, doesn't it, a fellowship? It's very meaningful to me because that's what I put on my passport. What am I? I'm a songwriter. That's my profession, and it's a profession I'm very proud of.
The first hit song you had was Roxanne. Do you remember listening to the chart countdown on Radio 1 the week that went into the
Yeah, I was in my kitchen in Bayswater on a plank on top of the ladders, painting the ceiling with some white emulsion, and I had Radio 1 on, and I suddenly recognised the song. It's Roxanne, and I literally fell off the ladder and immediately called the other guys in the band and said, we're on the radio. There, they were listening too. But nothing will ever beat that first, you know, time you hear it yourself on the radio. That is incredible.
I wondered, as a professional songwriter, have you been watching the Ed Sheeran copyright trial?
Yes.
What did you make of that?
I was glad that Ed won. I think the building blocks of music we hold in common, all of us, songwriters. It cannot be owned by any one person or any entity, much less can it be owned by artificial machine intelligence.
What's your take on that? Because I think there have been, I guess, what you could call convincing facsimiles of music.
It's similar to the way I watch a movie with CGI. It doesn't impress me at all. I get immediately bored when I see a computer-generated image. I imagine I will feel the same way about AI making music. You know, I think maybe for electronic dance music it works, but for songs, expressing emotions, I don't think I will be moved by it.
Sting, in conversation with our music correspondent Mark Savage. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Gareth Jones and produced by Tracy Gordon. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
It's the 11th of March, 2011. A massive earthquake measuring 9.1 on the Richter scale strikes the east coast of Japan. It cripples roads, severs power lines, and claims the lives of over 18,000 people. And then...
Mega tsunami warning! Repeat, mega tsunami warning!
The Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, still reeling from the quake, is struck by a tsunami. It crashes over the protective seawalls, flooding the facility, cutting its power. What follows is a full-scale nuclear emergency.
All control facilities inoperable. Water supply to reactor cores cut off.
Fukushima, an original 7-part audio drama series from the BBC World Service, telling the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath. Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.